So as we continue with this series, looking at the first letter of Paul to the Corinthians, our second readings, we've jumped over a few verses from last week to this week, and it'd be good to provide a bit of the context of what happened from verses 18 to 25 that we've jumped over. And to do that, we need to look at Julius Caesar. And so one of the things that we know about Caesar is the, at least the moment of his death. So does anyone remember about when it was that Julius Caesar was killed? The Ides of March, exactly. The Ides being what day in March? 15th, the middle of March, yes. The Ides of March in the year 44 BC. Because some of the conservative Republicans were fearful that President Trump, I mean, that Julius Caesar was wanting to establish himself as the new king, was wanting to take over all of things that the Republicans thought, no, that's not the way that Rome is meant to go. And so this plot was hatched and he was assassinated on this day. Now, most of the things that we know about this are in fact because of Shakespeare. That his play, Julius Caesar, provides lots of insights into that. And one of the major scenes of that play is these two long interactions between the citizens and first Marcus Brutus and then with Mark Antony. Now, Marcus Brutus, who was one of the conspirators, comes to really provide the reasons for why it was necessary that Caesar should die. But then Mark Antony takes to the stage and he begins by, well, of course, you know, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears, all of that. But then he begins to say, look, I'm no orator as Brutus is, even though Brutus's oratory is marked by this very pedestrian, very ordinary, very boring kind of description of what happened. Whereas Mark Antony then begins to use this very poetic, beautiful, flowery language that woos the whole crowd. And so they begin to eat out of his very hands. And it's one of those wonderful play on words, really, of what Shakespeare is capable of, but marking this turning point, not just in the play, but indeed in Roman history at that moment. So Paul is doing something similar in this particular passage that we have the second half of today from verses 26 to 31. He begins by talking about the nature of the cross, and he compares these two realities. He says, you know, this is not the wisdom of the world. That's not going to get us very far. Now, people in Greek culture, that was very significant for them. The whole concept of Sophia was at the heart of what it was to be Greek, not just in Athens, but also here in this town of Corinth, that it was very significant for them. And so he often does this. He compares and contrasts these two different ways of understanding reality. One thing about the flesh or the world or earthly or ordinary ways. And then he says, no, but there's this divine way of understanding things, this way of experiencing all that is necessary. And then he begins to talk about the cross. This is what he wants to talk about essentially, and the very fact of the person that this Jesus of Nazareth, crucified by the Romans, has been raised from the dead by God to be now the Lord of the earth. And he now calls and summons all people to faithful obedience to him. Now, this we take as a pretty ordinary kind of statement, and yet for anyone at that time, this was just preposterous. This is just outrageous. How could this be true? How could the cross, an instrument of Roman humiliation, an instrument where Jesus was defeated, how could he in any way, shape, or form be declared to be the Lord of the earth? This scandal, on this stumbling block, is there presented to the people because Jesus, as the Messiah, was meant to conquer. He was meant to lead the people of Israel back into a place of ascendancy. Instead, he was defeated. Instead, he was submitted to all that the Roman Empire and the brutality and the cruelty that was able to be inflicted upon Jesus, he took upon himself. I mean, it wasn't even that he was exalted by the Jewish people. No one thought that this was a good thing. No one said, yes, this is the source of salvation. And yet Paul knows that he needs to preach about the cross. He knows that the cross has to be at the very heart of all that he talks about. And it's this stumbling block that he struggles to make sense of. Because as he says, there's no wisdom of the world that offers this as a good thing. And yet he's wanting to continue to point us to the truth of the cross and the power of the cross, the transformation that is available. Because he knows that the only way that this is possible is with this change and this transformation of our hearts and our minds to be able to see what God in fact was wanting to do in and through the cross. Because the cross is foolishness. The cross just doesn't make any sense at all. And yet he's then beginning to, and this is where the rhetoric and the oratory comes in, and one of the finest places of Paul's oratory is laid bare before us today. Because he says, look, none of you, or how many of you were powerful when the Lord called you? How many of you were wise in the ways of the world? How many of you were influential people? And the answer to all of that is none of them. None of those people were anything significant at that time. And yet, the Lord continued to work. The Lord continued to call them. The Lord didn't care about their qualifications. The Lord didn't care how convicted they were, how significant they were. Even though the people of that time, as people in our own time, still saw that as a very significant and powerful thing. And he wants them to understand that the cross speaks into their hearts and into their lives, into their situations as well. He then goes on to say, you know, how many of you thought that you were somebody, but then, you know, in some ways you really discover that you're nobody at all in terms of this foolishness, in terms of the wisdom of the Lord. There's a story that's told about the Archbishop of Canterbury during the Second World War. And in those days, just as it was in the Catholic Church, there was no compulsory age for retirement for bishops. That came in much later. And so the Archbishop of Canterbury, you know, the head of the whole of the Anglican Communion, realizes that in his late 70s now, he's beginning to become increasingly frail and less capable of actually functioning and working within the church. And so he realizes that it's time for him to step down. But as he says to one of his confidants, the problem is that now I'm somebody, but then I will be nobody. It's this intriguing sense that you would hope that an archbishop would have worked out at some point in his life, that ability that none of us are really anybody significant. And yet we still strive to have that place of significance because of the whole cult of fame that exists within our world, and that sense that, you know, there are some people who are famous simply for being famous, whereas others are thankfully famous for being productive and useful and helpful within the world. But this call that Paul is wanting to lay bare before us, this whole sense that, no, the transformation that is available to us is about the change that God makes in our lives. And it's in that sense that we can then begin to realize those moments when we can turn away from ourselves and to God, and to boasting in Him and exalting in Him and praising Him and magnifying the Lord. But it's not about our own little lives that matter. That God will call us and God will invite us and God will transform us. Because as Paul says, the wisdom, the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of the world. And the weakness of God is stronger than the strength of humanity. This transformation that happens when we begin to understand what is at stake before us. And so that's why he's able to say, regardless of all of this, regardless of the foolishness of the message that I preach and proclaim, regardless of the fact that I stand convicted of this defeated King of the Jews who has now become the Lord of the world, I will boast in him. I will not boast in my achievements. I will not boast in anything that I have done. And the other great rhetorical passage in 2 Corinthians 10, he does something similar, speaking about the boasting in his own weakness and in the power of what God has done in his life. And it's for us to continue to really receive this gift and to be transformed and changed by that. It's what we will be doing also as we move as a parish into the experience of Alpha and the Alpha program that begins now in 10 days' time, opening ourselves to what God might do in and through us, receiving that proclamation, allowing the Lord to teach us and instruct us in the ways that He's calling us to go.